The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey folks, as we've seen, a lot can change in 4 years when it comes to U.S.-China relations. Things have gotten so bad that the very foundations of global stability are now under threat. However, the U.S. is about to have an election, you may have heard of, which may drastically change the direction of things, for better or for worse. That is why on November 11th and 12th, SubChina is hosting our fourth annual Next China Conference online. This year, we are gathering together China specialists from all different fields to discuss what impact the elections will have on the next 4 years of U.S.-China relations. If you are connected to China, this is a conference you will not want to miss. The event is free for SubChina Access subscribers. Now, that is a great reason to subscribe. Go to events.subchina.com to get your tickets and to learn more about our unbelievably great lineup of speakers. That's events.subchina.com. .supchina.com. We hope to see you there. Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China, especially if you subscribe to our daily email newsletter, SubChina Access. And visit subchina.com to check out our wide range of reported pieces, op-eds, videos, and, of course, podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from Nashville, Tennessee, is Jeremy Goldcorn, a.k.a. Jinyumi, the colorful character whose escapades and narrow escapes are at the center of the next Bradley Hope and Tom Wright book, Thousand Dollar Whale. Jeremy, greet the people.
Yeah, okay. I'm gonna boo. I'm gonna stop booing.
You can boo that one. Yeah, you know, it relates to what we're talking about today. So today we are delighted to have as our guest Sebastian Strangio. I had the great pleasure of getting to know Sebastian during the couple of years he spent in Chapel Hill, where I live, from 2016 to 2018, where his son was born. Anyway, we had many, many long and occasionally quite well lubricated talks on everything from history and politics to music and Sichuan cookery. And I actually owe him for turning me on to great headphones, these One More headphones, which I've actually endorsed on the show before, and to the music of Scriabin, which torments me to this day. Sebastian is the author of the 2014 book Hun Sen's Cambodia. And over beers in Chapel Hill, he told me about his new book project, which was published just last month and which I just cannot say enough good things about. The book is In the Dragon's Shadow, Southeast Asia in the Chinese Century, and it's a tour de force about the fraught and complicated relationships that the nations of Southeast Asia have with the continental colossus to their north. It's a book that's full of on-the-ground reporting from the offices of heads of state to these, you know, garish Chinese-funded gambling towns in Burma and in Cambodia. China aside, it's just a great book if you want to learn more about this important region. And the writing is just wonderful with that quality that I really prize, where it just never gets in the way. It allows all this, you know, the zooming in and the zooming out to be done really seamlessly. And it's really only noticeable when it offers up the delightful turn of phrase here and there. Sebastian, congratulations on this fantastic book, and welcome to Seneca.
Thanks a lot, Kaiser. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to finally have you on the show.
Yeah.
Sebastian, welcome. In the introduction to your book, you talk about how history and geography have set China's momentum inexorably southward. And in your chapter on Vietnam, you have someone pointing out how on a map, Vietnam almost looks like a woman bearing the huge weight of China, which sounds like a very unpleasant thing to do. Can you talk about why this is so and how it's a bit like the United States' westward expansion or Russia's drive eastward? And are you suggesting that the current push has anything to do with the historic southward movement, subconsciously or otherwise?
Well, I think that the southward drift of the Chinese, various Chinese empires, has its roots in the security dilemma that many of the Chinese empires faced, which was overwhelmingly a northern concern. I mean, these are empires that faced invasion and various depredations from the steppe peoples of the north and west. And so, of course, the Great Walls of China were built in the north. And, you know, to the south, there were no such powers that could seriously threaten the imperial center. And so there was a natural southward drift. This wasn't something that happened all at once. It was a long process of, you know, in-migration, you know, the slow extension of the Chinese imperial administrative state and logistical networks and the gradual annexation of new regions and their stitching into the empire. And I think that same, you know, I argue in the book that that same sort of freedom to the south exists today. You know, to the, you know, to the north, you have north and west, you have Russia. To the southwest, you have India. Off the eastern coast, you have a string of U.S. treaty allies, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines. Southeast Asia remains a region where there is no incumbent great power. And so it's the one place where the Chinese state is able to sort of break out of the chain of encirclement that they've always perceived as being, you know, as closing in on them. And so there is sort of a resumption, there has been a resumption of this historical drift to the south.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That sense of insecurity and encirclement almost makes them even more anxious about any additional encirclement happening out of Southeast Asia, interestingly. So, Sebastian, before we get into specific countries, let's talk about some of the sort of big picture region-wide issues. At the top of that list is, what does China ultimately want in the region? Clearly, you know, aside from its claims to the South China Sea, you don't see China as literally expansionist. You also don't agree with those who've suggested that China's goal is to supplant the so-called international rules-based order led by the United States. And you don't see it as quite the revisionist power that, that a lot of people do. So how would you describe then what China's intent is vis-a-vis Southeast Asia?
I think China wants what it once had. It wants to be the top dog in the region, and it wants to be respected as such. And that, of course, for Southeast Asia is a pretty serious demand. I think that China's, in terms of the global, you know, the rules-based international order, as some people describe it, I think China's intent is not to overturn this system and erect a new system of rules in its place, rules that are much more repressive and inhospitable to freedom. I think that China simply wants a greater control of the current system as it exists, and it wants to tweak some of the rules to better fit Chinese prerogatives and interests. You know, and this is actually something on which China is aligned with a number of the Southeast Asian nations. The foregrounding of national, the principle of national sovereignty, and this the principle of non-interference, mutual non-interference, is something which a lot of the Southeast Asian nations, as well as many other nations in the global South, are very much in favor of.
Right.
You know, at least in principle, the reality of Chinese interaction with these countries can sometimes create tensions with that that concept, and we can talk a bit further about that.
Let's talk about that exactly. China's GDP, which was over $14 trillion in 2019, was a 150% that of the entire ASEAN region, the total for the same year, which was about $9.3 trillion. Off the top of your head, do you happen to have the major trade stats, like how many of the 11 nations of Southeast Asia have China as their largest trading partner or stuff like that? I guess what I'm after is a sense of how much is ASEAN constrained in its choices because of its deep economic ties, or one might say deep economic dependency on China?
Well, the region is, you know, deeply enmeshed with China. 8 of the 10 Association of Southeast Asian Nations member states are China's their leading trade partner. On foreign investment, China comes in second to Japan, but it is growing very quickly. The Belt and Road Initiative has led to a, you know, surge of Chinese investment into the region. Of course, not all of those projects have eventuated, but the numbers have increased quite considerably. You know, this economic entanglement makes it very difficult for Southeast Asia or for Southeast Asian nations to take strong stances against China or to enlist in any sort of anti-China coalition.
Mm-hmm.
They want the benefits of trading with China. They also want to benefit from the American security presence in the region. And, you know, herein lies Southeast Asia's predicament in an era of rising Sino-American tensions. There's American demands that Southeast Asia, you know, forestall its economic relationships with China in various domains have so far fallen on deaf ears.
Right. American security interests turn out to be, you know, a source of grave insecurity for China sometimes. The other side of all that trade, not just with the region, but globally, makes, you know, parts of that region especially of particular strategic consequence for China. You mentioned in your book that I think it's like 90,000 container vessels, which is half of the global merchant shipping tonnage, passes through the Strait of Malacca each year. And I think 80% of China's imported oil, and it imports about 70% of its oil, passes through the strait. So, I mean, that's a major vulnerability, no matter how you cut it. I wonder whether you think China's strategy in the region actually, though, has made it more vulnerable or less vulnerable. Has the antagonism actually increased the vulnerability?
I think that's a good, you know, one could definitely make that argument, that China has always perceived and feared a U.S.-led containment strategy.
Right.
But the very actions that China's taken to forestall such a containment has only, you know, increased the interest of major powers to constrain Chinese ambitions. And
right.
So you sort of see the Quad to be revived and to become more coherent in its approach toward China. India's gradually being coaxed out of its
Sebastian, could I interrupt you and just ask for a quick one-line definition of the Quad, because it's been in the news actually today as we record this.
Well, the Quad is sort of a loose, I don't know if you would call it, it's not an alliance, but a loose partnership between India, Japan, Australia, and the United States. And it's being marketed as sort of a democratic partnership that can help to constrain Chinese assertiveness.
Great. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
Of course. And the Chinese, Chinese actions have elicited a response. There's almost a sort of natural, it's almost a natural law that when one great power begins acting in a belligerent way, other powers that feel threatened by it will seek to counteract that, those actions. And in the case of China, you know, this is one thing that China has to deal with that the United States rarely has had to deal with, is the fact that there are powerful rivals in its neighborhood. As I mentioned before, you know, you have Japan, India, potentially Russia, South Korea, and of course the United States in the region as well. And so it's not a region in which China can get everything its own way.
Right.
Whereas in the Western Hemisphere, the United States had, you know, two massive oceans on either side and relatively weak neighbors. And I think this, you know, trying to gain that freedom is a lot of what China's recent assertiveness has been about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're trying to pack the whole Eastern Pacific into the nine dash line. Not easy.
Right, right. Yeah.
So Beijing typically doesn't like to deal with large organizations with a lot of members that are supposed to agree on things, but prefers to deal one-on-one with countries, especially smaller countries that they can kind of bully around, if I may offer my cynical opinion on this. I think this is true in the EU, and, you know, you see it elsewhere. Is this true with respect to ASEAN versus individual member states? How much weight does ASEAN as an organization have with China? And are they seeking to sort of undermine it and deal one-on-one with its member states?
This is very much the case. When it comes to the disputes in the South China Sea, China's made it very clear that these are bilateral questions that should be settled in a bilateral manner. This is China's official line. And I think it's obvious that, you know, in bilateral negotiations, China has a, you know, massively lopsided advantage. In terms of ASEAN itself, you know, China has gone through the motions and the rituals of taking part in negotiations, you know, glacial negotiations on a code of conduct in the South China Sea, which would, you know, in theory would set down some rules of the road and prevent any disputes from escalating into something more serious. But, you know, these things are, you know, really should be seen as ways of buying diplomatic time. China Right. still sees that its interests are best served in dealing one-on-one with the countries involved. And ASEAN has always, you know, had the problem on its own end of forging a unified position on China. I mean, you have 10 member states with vastly divergent interests, political cultures, histories, et cetera, et cetera. And these countries see China in very different ways. You know, for some countries, China is a protective giant that can keep more proximate neighbors in line, whereas for others, China is the source of threat, and they're, you know, they're deeply suspicious and fearful of its intentions. And so there's a sort of, you know, it's been, as ASEAN expanded its membership after the end of the Cold War to include Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar, the interests of the region or the 10 member states became so much more divergent. Mm. And that's really made it hard for them to reach any sort of consensus on important issues.
Sebastian, one of several through lines in the book, irrespective of what country you're talking about, you know, in all the chapters of your book, is the role of ethnic Chinese communities in the relationship. I should say that it's quite a tour of Chinese communities that you offer in the course of the book, and they all play different roles in the different relationships, you know, the different bilateral relationships. But there are definitely some common themes that emerge. It's a big, big topic, I know, but maybe you could talk through some of those themes.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the ethnic Chinese have always faced challenges in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. During the Cold War, many of them were viewed as a fifth column for Beijing and subject to a range of discriminatory measures by the states of the region. Going back further to the colonial period, you know, ethnic Chinese were subject to prejudice, discrimination, even violence at various points. And so it's important to recognize this background when talking about the, you know, the current Chinese policy toward ethnic Chinese in the region. Over the last few years, President Xi Jinping has begun to, you know, deepen China's outreach to these communities.
Right.
He's begun to, you know, speak about them as members of the great Chinese family and call upon them to join in the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and the building of the China dream. And I think this is, you know, for many of the communities in the region, this is worrying. After the end of the Cold War, when relations between China and the ASEAN states began to improve, one of the effects of that was that ethnic Chinese were able to express themselves more fully. They were able to be ethnically Chinese while also loyal members of the nations that they called home. And this acceptance of ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia was really premised on China maintaining a very clear division between ethnic affiliations and political loyalty to the Chinese state. And in, you know, the Chinese new Chinese nationality law in 1980 clarified that distinction. And this was really one of the key things that helped pave the way toward improved relations between China and many of the nations of Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what we're seeing now is this, you know, this increasing outreach begin to blur those distinctions once again. And, you know, I think that it's reawakening or runs the risk of reawakening dormant fears of dual loyalties
right.
on the part of ethnic Chinese.
It's not doing them any favors, really. It's true. I mean, it's all over Southeast Asia we're seeing that. But I'm tempted to draw comparisons to how Beijing views Chinese populations in the U.S., for example, you know, where I live. I feel like there's not as much of a claim being made. I mean, people seem to be comfortable with the idea of Chinese ethnicity and American nationality. And same is true to an extent, I think, probably for Australia, although, you know, we've seen examples, you know, to the contrary. But in Southeast Asia, that claim is made, even though often we're talking about generations upon generations, you know, away from China. What do you think accounts for that difference?
Well, there's a couple of things that complicate the picture in Southeast Asia. The first is that in many parts of the region, ethnic Chinese have there are vocal minorities who've never accepted ethnic Chinese as legitimate members of the national community. In Indonesia and Malaysia, particularly Muslim majority countries, there is a rising tide of exclusionary Islamic inflected nationalism, which paints Chinese as outsiders to the national community. Right. And there's all of these tropes about ethnic Chinese bleeding the country, all of these, racist tropes that go back many generations in the region. And then on the other hand as well, you have, quite a large number of new Chinese migrants who have come to the region since reform and opening, particularly since the end of the Cold War, who have established businesses. There are tens of thousands of Chinese students and millions of Chinese tourists. And so the Chinese state has a legitimate interest in protecting the interests of its citizens abroad. But it's very, it's very difficult to maintain a clear distinction between card-carrying PRC citizens and ethnic Chinese who've been in the region for a very long time.
Yep.
And, it's one of the problems with Chinese cultural outreach is that there's a very, very blurred line between, promoting the Chinese language and Chinese culture and political questions. These often bleed into each other in the way that China engages with Chinese language institutes and chambers of commerce. And I think that kind of vague distinction between political issues and cultural issues is one of the, one of the main subjects for concern in the region.
That's right. China has never gotten completely comfortable with the idea of, sort of Westphalian nation states. It's still kind of got that civilizational take on it.
That's true, yeah.
And the problem is complex even in the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, where you don't have, necessarily an Islamist, local resistance to the Chinese population. So I don't think it's a complicated matter. Sebastian, there is a really useful concept that you bring up a few times throughout the book, great state autism, which me being something of a sort of illiterate when it comes to scholarly works was fairly new to me. It was coined by the historian Eduard Luttwak. And I just love this word, great state autism, particularly as somebody from a small state who's lived most of my adult life in China, now America. I'm sort of aware of what it means. I think I feel it viscerally. I feel it in my bones.
Oh, yeah.
So it's something we've seen with all the great states, whether the United States, Russia, India, and of course, more relevant to our discussion today with China. Can you quickly define the term and give us some examples of how it manifests itself in China's relationship with Southeast Asian nations?
Well, the term, I think, it refers to really the difficulty that any large power has in seeing the detail, in seeing the granular reality of the nations with which it interacts. Luttwak talks about the tendency for large nations to come up with ways of simplifying the world in order that they can grasp it and make policy towards it. In Southeast Asia, China's particular variant of great state autism has manifested as, its inability really to engage effectively with any organization or group that lies beyond the remit of the state. I think that, few countries are better at China than at doing state pageantry and pomp. China is very comfortable at dealing with red carpet receptions, state-to-state and party-to-party relationships. But when it comes to sort of public diplomacy and outreach, the Chinese Communist Party is awkward. I don't think they've ever quite grasped that soft power cannot be formulated from the top down. It really is something that emerges unbidden from within a society's dynamics. And one of the most remarkable things about American soft power is that it often has emerged in tension with cherished American myths and ideals. And that even as people may oppose the United States government or some of its particular actions, they are very much attracted to the American creed and American culture and its many manifestations. So that's one way. What we see in Southeast Asia is Chinese officialdom has a tin ear for public concern.
Mm.
And even to the very idea that Chinese activities and behaviors could elicit negative reactions to begin with. I think another important manifestation of great state autism is China's policy toward overseas Chinese. We mentioned this just before, but the inability to grasp how sensitive this issue is in Southeast Asia, or to understand that but push ahead anyway with deepening outreach, is something that is probably one of the most fraught elements of China's relationship with the region today, and could potentially inhibit quite seriously the expansion of Chinese influence in the region.
You see, I mean, and yet here they are on this supposed charm offensive. We all know how things are going to end with that. You know, more examples you can cite about, you know, Lu Wex's great state autism. You know, China is to soft power what Nickelback is to hard rock, basically.
Right.
But
you thought about that for a bit.
I didn't.
That wasn't spontaneous.
It was.
Okay.
80,000 students, though, from ASEAN who are studying in China in 2016. So it hasn't entirely been a failure, right? I mean, there are people who are very attracted. I mean, I know if you, there's like huge fandoms for Chinese, costume dramas and stuff like that all over Southeast Asia. The Chinese, celebrities, these sort of androgynous looking boys in these bands, just like Korea a few years ago, they're enjoying a huge surge of popularity right now across the region. So, it's not all gone disastrously, right?
No, I think that's true. I mean, the Cantonese language soaps are hugely popular in Singapore and other parts of the region, although they're dubbed into Mandarin by the Singaporean government as part of its language policy. But,
into Singlish. That would be really fun.
Right. There's definitely a presence there. But I think it's something that the Chinese government has done very little to encourage and in many ways is made more difficult. I think that China's basic strategy in the region is economic. I think good dialectical materialists, the Chinese Communist Party, figure that, at the end of the day, money is going to win out, that the region will be drawn towards China by the, 1,000 threads of economic entanglement, and that, ultimately this will be the thing that ensures that China's achieves its goals in the region and that nations sort of fall in line with its broader strategic aims.
Cold hard cash is better than Gangnam Style.
Yeah,
right. And one could indeed ask the question, how much does popularity really matter? I mean, I've had this question quite often about, you look at opinion polls and China. China's not popular in many parts of Southeast Asia. The United States is generally more popular amongst ordinary publics, although not unequivocally. Depends on the country and the time. But in general, the United States has a reservoir of public support,
sure,
and goodwill that the Chinese state lacks. But there really is, the question of to what extent this figures in the long run, in the long term pursuit of Chinese aims, really an open question. It's hard to know.
So, Sebastian, let's get into some nitty-gritty. Let's get into the individual countries now. I don't know if we have enough time to get into all of them, but it's kind of amazing how it feels reading your book. Like, each of the countries works quite nicely as an illustration of one of the major issues the region as a whole is experiencing in its relationship with China.
Mm-hmm.
Can you quickly map out the themes you decided to focus on with each of the countries you cover, or at least some of them?
Oh, it's a big question. Well, so I think I'll start, I'll go in order. So Vietnam, Vietnam is the nation that is the closest to China geographically, culturally, and politically. In some ways, it's the nation that encapsulates all of the region's dilemmas vis-a-vis China.
Right.
The crushing proximity, the need to remain on good terms with China, and the economic entanglement with it. Vietnam faces Chinese power on land, in terms of, most of the invasions from China, all of the invasions from China have come from land. China's damming of the Upper Mekong River as having huge effects in the Mekong Delta, a region where the river is too wide to provide to dam for hydropower. And so Vietnam gets all of the downsides of China's hydropower development with none of the potential benefits for itself. And it also faces Chinese power at sea. It's a major claimant in the South China Sea. So, you know, Vietnam, I kicked off with Vietnam basically because I think it brings together, it faces many of the strategic, or encapsulates many of the strategic challenges that the region faces.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe if I would add another one, it's also got that, it's got a government because of its, you know, shared Communist Party affiliation that's close with China sometimes, while it has a population that's very much at odds with China, right? I mean, that's
exactly
another one of those things, yeah.
And culturally, it's been so deeply imprinted by China.
Yeah, for sure.
That it really, you know, it's the only nation in the region that we can really say that of, that it's really Sinitic in the way that it, you know, its social structure, its political system, you know, its language,
right.
All of these things have been, you know, deeply imprinted. And indeed, these tools that Vietnam has borrowed from China have been the very things that have enabled it to avoid absorption by the Chinese Empire, historically. So there's a deep irony at the heart of Vietnam-China relations, which makes it in some ways unique in the region.
Maybe we can talk about themes and then talk about countries that use to illustrate them. Like one of those themes that just brought up, the sort of the Chinese community in diaspora, although it threads through the whole thing, it seems to be like the really important point in the Malaysia chapter, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, Malay nationalism, which has been sort of the driving force of Malaysian politics since independence, was really born out of an anxiety and a fear about ethnic Malay people becoming strangers in their own land. During the British colonial period, you know, the authorities imported huge numbers of migrants from southern China and from parts of southern India. And by, you know, on the eve of independence in 1957, you know, ethnic Malays were actually, for a brief period, a minority in Peninsular Malaya. And so this anxiety has continued to resonate in Malaysian politics.
Yeah, for sure.
The question of Malay prerogatives and sort of, you know, policies to prop up the Malay people, affirmative action essentially for a majority, has been a running theme in Malaysian politics since independence. And, you know, this fear that the ethnic Chinese are economically dominant and, you know, sucking the country dry remains a potent trope in sort of right-wing Malay circles.
Yeah, you've got a great example of this. I mean, again, an example of great state autism, although it's being done by a Chinese developer, is how you open that whole chapter about talking about Forest City, which is just amazing. I mean, just so tone deaf.
This remarkable property development, which, you know, was mostly targeted at PRC citizens, right. You know, at ethnic Chinese from China. But it was built, you know, it was going to be built on artificial islands in the Johor Strait across from Singapore. And for any history-minded Malay nationalist, you know, this calls to mind the example of Singapore,
right.
Which was expelled from Malaysia in 1965, in large part due to questions about to do with ethnic relations between Chinese and Malays. When I interviewed former Prime Minister Mahathir about this, you know, he brought up that example. He said that, you know, when this enclave could, if it becomes filled up with Chinese, it could end up, you know, separating from Malaysia. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, fear mongering here. I don't think it was likely necessarily to go that way, but it just shows the depth of the, you know, the resonance of this question in Malaysia today.
Yeah, when I was first in China, I used to try and escape in the mid-90s, like 96, 97, by holidays in Laos and Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam. And I'd always expected people to be quite receptive to the fact that I spoke some Chinese and was like down with Asians. And
nope.
It always shocked me at the depth of resentment that I encountered when I said I lived in China.
Well, that was a difficult time. I mean, if it was 97, I mean, the Asian financial crisis. And, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I know, but it's... let me ask a serious question. Sebastian, so you have spent many years living in Cambodia, and you've written what many would regard as the book on the Hun Sen regime, or government, perhaps we can call it, since we call that name for China and the United States. Cambodia clearly has the closest and probably warmest relationship with China of any Southeast Asian nation. But even so, there are many, many problems. And you write Sihanoukville, which I visited before the casinos opened, when it was like a banana town. Sihanoukville has become, or became at least briefly, a den of iniquity for Chinese gamblers and revelers, although one has to say it was always a den of iniquity of one kind or another.
Correct.
But can you talk about that a little bit, and the popular Cambodian reaction to these developments in Sihanoukville?
Well, you know, to understand Cambodia's embrace of China, you know, that we need to grasp two basic points. The first is that, you know, historically, Cambodia had been a pretty welcoming place for the Chinese. The common attitudes towards Chinese people have been relatively positive. The real bogeyman of the Khmer nationalist imagination was the Vietnamese. And in fact, Cambodian attitudes towards the Vietnamese mirror almost perfectly Vietnamese attitudes towards the Chinese. And so what you have is a nation that, you know, or a kingdom that during the long centuries of decline, you know, after the Angkorian Empire sort of crumbled, you know, its territory was gradually sort of eaten away from east and west by Vietnam and the Kingdom of Siam from the west. But the Vietnamese have been a particularly, you know, I think because the Cambodian-Vietnamese border also represents a cultural, linguistic, and religious fault line in a way that's not true of its western border, the Vietnamese have really been the driving force of the forging of the Cambodian national identity. So this means that China is seen in relatively benign light as a power that can help keep the Vietnamese at bay and to sort of ensure Cambodia's territorial integrity from the depredations of its neighbors closer to hand. It's also the second factor that's really driven this relationship between China and Cambodia is the large-scale UN-led effort to transform Cambodia into a democracy in the early 1990s. There's a lot of backstory here, and I won't go into a lot of the detail, but basically in 1991, there was a massive international peace treaty that was signed that aimed to end Cambodia's civil war and reproduce the country as a Western-style democracy. And this led to, you know, the deep involvement of many Western democracies in providing aid to the country and sort of pushing it towards democratic reforms. And for, you know, for various reasons, which I'm happy to expand on further if you like, Prime Minister Hun Sen, who was incumbent at the time, viewed this project, this democracy-building project, with a huge amount of concern and fear and sought to oppose it at every
surprise,
turn.
Surprise, surprise.
And, you know, over the years, he was able to sort of gradually ensure that elections went his way. He was able to sort of make sure that his critics, you know, he kept his critics in a box. Periods of repression made sure that the CPP grip on power remained secure. And over time, he was able to pay less and less attention to the opinion of, you know, a lot of his Western patrons, in large part due to China's rise.
Right.
And, you know, this really spotlights the appeal of China's doctrine of non-interference. You know, Hun Sen has been one of the most eager, you know,
advocates of
Hun Sen advocates, yes, of that principle. And so, you know, this international-led effort has, you know, created a counter-reaction, which has compounded the historically accommodative view of Chinese power that Cambodia has had, and as a result, Cambodia has become, you know, the friendliest nation towards China in Southeast Asia. Now, you know, that's the government, of course.
Right.
At the grassroots, things are a little bit more complicated. And I think you mentioned Sihanoukville, Jeremy. That's, you know, the developments there were so rapid and so sudden and so unbounded by any sort of effective regulation that the, you know, the backlash and the popular attitudes towards China, you know, have really taken a nosedive in Cambodia.
Yeah.
My most recent visits there, I've spoken to people, and the general attitude towards China and the Chinese people are very sour, you know. And I think that, you know, the developments in Sihanoukville, when I went to visit, there was literally dozens of these small casinos that are, you know, run by very questionable PRC concessionaires, catering overwhelmingly to Chinese tourists. You know, a lot of the reporting from Sihanoukville seems a little bit hyperbolic, but I was actually surprised to find that it was pretty much accurate. this I think illustrates well the difficulty that the Chinese government has in keeping a tight rein on the activities of its nationals.
The
Belt and Road came to Cambodia, and the Chinese government began promoting investment in the country, but you know, the lack of regulation in Cambodia and the corruption in the country has enabled some of the, you know, a host of investments that are actually damaging China's reputation in the country and potentially its most important partnership.
I have to say, though, you know, if I think of Sihanoukville, which I've spent a little bit of time in, all of this was before the Chinese sort of arrival there. All of the Westerners, mostly Americans, that I met there were engaged in the most dodgy enterprises one could imagine. You know, this is not new. It's just that the Chinese built it to scale.
That's exactly it. Like everything to do with China, the devil is in the scale.
Yeah.
Sihanoukville, the Chinese developments in Sihanoukville hadn't really begun, or they'd maybe just begun when I left Cambodia to go to the U.S. in 2016. Within 2 or 3 years, it had transformed the city. So what we're seeing is the same old bad behavior scaled up, you know, in line with China's
it's just
population
size. Once it was a guest house with some sleazy American like owner arranging whatever sleazy stuff. Now it's like a 40-story hotel with fountains and stuff,
yeah.
And the same sleazy stuff.
Going on,
100X.
Precisely, yeah. It's important to remember.
Sebastian, okay. I found the chapter on Burma to have some parallels with that. I mean, it was really interesting in part, I mean, because so much can still go right from Beijing's perspective. I mean, kind of like with Hun Sen, as Aung San Suu Kyi finds herself sort of a pariah because of the Rohingya issue, she's sort of drifting into Beijing's arms, or at least that's how a lot of people understand it. You know, they have so much in common, the shared defensiveness, allegations of gross human rights violations against Muslim minorities.
Right, right.
But there's also just a ton at stake, the possibility of a land route via high-speed rail to the Indian Ocean. Give me a sense of where things stand right now with China and Burma. Is it still sort of in play, as it were?
Well, the Burmese state finds itself in a liminal bind with regard to China. You have, you know, on the one hand, you know, there's this deep fear and suspicion of China, which runs through the ranks of the Burmese military and governing establishment. Of course, it's important to remember that Burma had an active communist insurgency, very actively funded by the Chinese Communist Party and supported by it. That lasted through to the end of the 1980s. And many of the senior commanders in the Burmese military cut their teeth fighting Chinese-backed Burmese communist insurgents in the north of the country. And so, you know, there's always been a deep suspicion and concern, as there is for every nation that shares a border with China or has experienced historically experienced encounters with, you know, Chinese state power. And so, you know, there's the push to open relations with the West in 2011 and 2012 was driven at least in part by a desire to diversify Burma's foreign relations and build cooperative ties with Western democracies after years of isolation and pariah status. The difficulty now is that many of these Western nations, after a period of euphoria and you know that followed these political reforms and the election of Aung San Suu Kyi to the country's leadership in 2015, is that the horrific treatment of the Rohingya minority of Rakhine State in the west of Burma has, you know, has soured a lot of these nations on engagement with the country.
Right.
And so there's not really, you know, this has reduced the options that the Burmese government has in terms of establishing a counterweight to China and maintaining a healthy diversity of in its foreign relations. You know, not all of them have balked, of course. You know, the Japanese have continued to engage very pragmatically. India has also taken a pragmatic position on its relations with Burma. But, you know, you have this constant tug towards Beijing, given the international pressure that the regime is coming over its various human rights questions, particularly the Rohingya issue. And so there's sort of like an inevitable drift towards China. And due to the deeply entrenched racial and sectarian divisions within the country, problems that are not going to be solved anytime soon. It's been very difficult for the Burmese government to maintain, as I said, a healthy, balanced diet in its foreign relations.
So Singapore, Singaporean diplomats seem to be pretty pleased with themselves about how well they deal with China, and some other people don't agree with them, some of whom we've interviewed recently. Do you think that Singapore is able to navigate the space between the US and China very well, Sebastian? Or are they just all talk and no walk?
Well, I think so far they've managed admirably. I quote somebody in my book saying, Singapore is the one nation in the world that can claim to have a special relationship with both China and the United States. But, you know, to a certain extent, there was sort of a couple decades, I kind of refer to it as a golden age, where Southeast Asian nations had the benefit of a rising China and the economic, benefits that came from that without the having to face the power of a, newly confident and resurgent Chinese state. And I think that, to a large extent, Southeast Asia as a region has managed that balance pretty well up until, maybe the end of the first decade of this century. I think Singapore has, enviable resources in terms of its diplomatic corps. It is, its economic vitality has made it a very, has given it, the financial resources necessary to become a crucial partner of both superpowers. And it's probably one of the most far-sighted nations in terms of its foreign relations, in terms of planning ahead and crafting a coherent strategy toward the coming age of great power competition. So yeah, I would say that Singapore has been, on the whole, pretty successful at managing this balance. Now, the difficulty going forward, of course, and this applies to the entire region, is that this balancing act of being able to benefit from China's economy while, remaining open to the stabilizing presence of the American military is becoming increasingly difficult to maintain, given the tensions between China and the U.S.,
Yeah, it's quite a pickle. Let's talk about Indonesia, Sebastian. Indonesia, given its enormous population, it's like, 270 million people, that's like 40% of the total of ASEAN, and with its very fraught relationship with its own ethnic Chinese population, historically, you would think that it would be, maybe more pivotal than it actually has been. But what you describe is a country that's actually been pretty low-key. I mean, of course, like most of the countries in the region, it is walking a fine line, but its voice doesn't seem to be commensurate with its size and with its weight. Can you give us a sense of what things look like viewed from Jakarta?
Well, from Jakarta's perspective, Indonesia might have a massive population, but it's a country with serious nation building and economic challenges. Any government that comes to power in Jakarta is faced with the question of how to, improve the economic condition of its people and to bind this unwieldy archipelago of islands more tightly together. I mean, the fact that Indonesia, you know, since the end of the Cold War, since independence, really, has been, you know, fighting a series of regional rebellions and separatist movements, gives you an indication of just how artificial the idea of Indonesia
right,
is,
right, right.
And how much work has had to go into knitting together a national identity and bringing outlying regions, you know, into the national fold. Yeah. I mean, there's still, you know, separatist, or, you know, push for autonomy in West Papua, which the Indonesian government continues to, you know, repress quite fiercely. The region of Aceh, prior to the tsunami of 2004, was, you know, had been waging in an insurgency for for decades against the central state. And so I think that when we talk about Indonesia punching below its weight, which is a common, you know, is a common theme in much Western commentary on the country, you know, it's difficult to extrapolate from population size to, you know, a diplomatic clout or economic clout in such a linear way. I think Indonesia is it's got a sort of centripetal momentum to it, is that, you know, governments are always looking inwards and trying to sort out the country's manifold challenges.
Trying to hold it
really
all together.
Don't have a lot of bandwidth left over for you know, thinking about Indonesia's role on the global stage.
That's completely understandable. Speaking of Jakarta, I have a friend named Kate Lamb who covers Southeast Asia for Reuters. Before Javier Bolsonaro of Brazil showed up, she would describe Tropical Trump and referred to Duterte, of course. You know, he's very Trumpian, Duterte is, to the point where, like Trump, I mean, he courts authoritarian powers and delights in sticking his finger in the eye of democratic allies, long-standing democratic allies. What struck me was how you conclude in the chapter on the Philippines with the suggestion that actually he's changed things, that people in the Philippines aren't any longer going to be able to take for granted the, you know, close alignment with the U.S. that's characterized the relationships since the American conquest of the Philippines in the turn of the century. Can you talk about that, about the changes in Duterte's foreign policy?
Well, it's, you know, the Philippines finds itself in a very difficult position. You know, it's the one nation in Southeast Asia that is both a treaty ally of the United States and a claimant in the South China Sea. And so the Philippines sits on the front line of the escalating tensions between China and the United States. It is, you know, I think the current administration, you know, if we put Duterte to one side for one second and look at his foreign policy team, you know, they're deeply conflicted about, you know, their position, their frontline position, and to what extent they want American support.
Right.
I mean, I think they want the U.S. as a bulwark against China, but they don't want to be drawn into a war between the two powers, a war that would very likely be fought out
in the front yard,
you know, right. areas close to right. the Philippines. Exactly. So there's this very, you know, maintaining that balance has been incredibly difficult. You mix Duterte into the mix and you have, you know, a further volatile compound.
I'll say.
You know, a leader who is, you know, has historically been resentful of the United States for, you know, a number of nationalist questions. He's from the south of the Philippines, from Mindanao, where memories of massacres carried out by American occupying troops in the early part of the 20th century remain very much alive. And he's also had association with left-wing political movements and individuals. And of course, you know, these are the main anti-American constituency in Philippine politics. A minority constituency, but a very vocal one historically. And I think that, you know, we see the same sort of tensions in the Philippines that we see in places like Burma and Cambodia, that when Western nations have come in and criticized leaders over, on human rights questions or about, you know, questions of democratic backsliding, you know, these leaders very often turn toward China, a country that's willing to engage without these questions being an issue and is willing to offer, you know, diplomatic support and economic financial aid without any, you know, with no strings, as they like to say.
Yeah.
So we've seen that same dynamic play out in the Philippines as well, where, you know, Duterte's presided over a fierce war on drugs, which has led to, you know, upwards of 10,000 deaths.
Wow. I didn't realize that the death toll is so high. My God.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely horrific, really. I mean, more people have died under the Duterte's drug war than died under martial law.
During Marcos.
Under Marcos.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, you know, there's a good argument that Western nations should be taking a stand on this question, but, you know, it has created tensions in the relationship with the Philippines under Duterte. And I think that there's an overall sense, in the country that, at least with this current administration, that, you know, it needs to craft an independent foreign policy that, you know, looks out for Filipino interests. And, you know, my concern with the Philippines is that, you know, while they have some of the most able individuals of any nation I visited in Southeast Asia, really sharp people I met while I was there, the structures and institutions are weak.
Yeah.
The president has a great deal of power to set the foreign policy of the country, and you see very little strategic follow through and consistency. I spoke to a Singaporean foreign ministry official who lamented that every time there's a new election in the Philippines, a new country is born.
Right.
So,
are you talking about the United States or the Philippines?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, you know, the Philippines is a photostat of the American political system circa, you know, 1900. So in some ways, we see similar dynamics in the Philippines as we see in the United States. The focus on political freedoms over economic redistribution. The
guns,
you know, the guns, massive income inequalities, and, you know, the rise of a figure like Duterte, who is able to, capitalize on a lot of the resentments and economic suffering of the population, you know, and that's, you know, the American influence in the Philippines runs very deep.
Indeed. 4 more years of Trump and we'd have the same kind of a failed state that we're seeing there. Oh, anyway,
it's already failed. Yeah.
It's too late.
You, as I've reminded you before, you Americans just don't realize that it's already failed. I mean, we Americans. Right. I'm one of you now, but
we're out there over the canyon, like Wile E. Coyote, still spinning our feet.
Right.
Spinning your feet,
Sebastian. Thank you so much. It's just a fantastic book, and I cannot recommend it more highly. I can't wait to see what you got planned next. Well, let's move on to recommendations. First, a quick reminder that the best way to support the work that we're doing with Seneca and all the network shows is to subscribe to our SubChina Access newsletter. If you aren't already subscribing, please do. It's really amazing, and you'll find that it is money well spent. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, you are up first. What you got?
Quick one. A True Grit, the novel by Charles Portis, upon which two movies have been based, one starring John Wayne, filmed in 1969, and one more recent, I think 2010, by the Coen brothers. But the book is so great.
Really?
It is wonderful. It is the best thing I've read in such a long time. It's kind of escapist, but not totally. It's very American. It's great. It was out of print for a long time, but it's back in print.
All right.
And read this thing. Like, you need to undepress yourself by reading this thing. True Grit by Charles Portis.
Great recommendation. I have seen the old film, have not seen the new one, but I'll read the book.
Forget the film. Okay. Read the book.
Sebastian, what do you have for us?
Well, I think I'd like to recommend a book that I actually bought and read while I was living in North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
So it's a book by the Austrian novelist Stefan Zweig, who wrote a memoir right towards the end of his life called The World of Yesterday. And this is a remarkably prescient book if you read it from the standpoint of 2020. He wrote this, I believe, during the Second World War. While he was in exile in France shortly before his death by suicide. And he describes the world of the pre-World War I era in Central Europe. This remarkable period of economic advancement, of liberal optimism.
The Belle Époque.
And cultural fecundity. And the sort of complacency that characterized that era, that everything was secure and safe, and nothing could possibly derail you know, the constant incremental improvement of the societies of the time. And I think that reading that today, you know, you get a, you know, this quite jolting and disorienting sense that the same thing is playing out today. And I found it to be, you know, a very, you know, kind of an unnerving book, but also, you know, a book that reminds us that a lot of these things we take for granted in terms of, you know, democratic institutions and liberal principles are fragile. And they were they've never been as secure as we've, you know, over the last few decades assumed. You know, often assumed.
Wow, that sounds great, Stefan Zweig.
Say the name of the book and the author again, please.
So it's Stefan Zweig. That's Z-W-E-I-G. Mm-hmm. Stefan with an F, and the book's called The World of Yesterday. Yeah, it's a really remarkably prescient book, and I think it, you know, it fits our current era alarmingly well.
Not sure I want to read that. I'm reading enough stuff that's just got me depressed.
Well, read True Grit. It'll divert you for a moment.
I'm not sure what my recommendation will do to people's moods. It really depends. But I'm going to recommend a Swedish progressive metal band called So.
It will destroy all of our moods.
Sebastian, I like this. It's really great. The band is called Soen, S-O-E-N, and no umlaut. It's kind of a super group that features artists from a bunch of other bands that I like. Start with the album Lykaia. Lykaia from 2017. Work your way forward and backward through the catalog of, I think, four or five albums. If you like bands like Tool or Opeth, especially Opeth's more recent stuff without the death growling, you know, with its sung, because it's all sung. It's not growled. I think you'll dig this. It's really melodic, but also really satisfyingly savage where it needs to be. And because it's prog metal, it's very cerebral and it's very chopsy, but without being like over the top show offy chopsy. It's the focus is on really good songwriting. It's great. I think their early albums sound a little too much like Tool, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but, great, great music. You should check it out. Sebastian, thank you once again. I mean, it was really good to see you, I can't wait to...
You too, Kaiser.
Yeah, let's do this again soon. I want to get you...
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Kaiser, I'm going to run. Okay, bye.
Okay, see you, Jeremy.
All right, Jeremy, nice to meet you.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the other shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.